From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. This week, Iranians returned to the polls for the first time since 2009's presidential election, widely believed to have been rigged, sparked massive protests that were crushed by the government. In Friday's parliamentary vote, the leadership offered citizens a choice between hardline and harder-line candidates, but the electorate's most crucial decision was whether to vote at all. Opposition groups and reformers have called for a boycott of the elections, but the government pressured citizens to vote to show the world that they believe in Iran's political process. As we're recording this on Friday, the government has claimed, quote, massive turnout, while foreign journalists in Iran report meager numbers at the polls. This despite heavy restrictions on where media could go and to whom they could talk on election day. Mohammad Sahimi covers Iran for the Tehran Bureau blog. He told us that citizens who declined to vote would not be able to hide from that decision.
When Iranians go to polling stations, they carry a birth certificate of several pages, and the last page of that birth certificate is a stamp that indicates that this person actually voted on March 2, 2012. So when later on they go, for example, to a governmental organization, ask for something, or when their management, where they work, summon them to prove that they have voted, they can check their birth certificate and see whether they have actually voted or not. But at the same time, of course, there is a very large segment of the population that does not deal with the government directly in this way, or is willing to accept the risk and not go to polling stations.
So in this contest, within a contest, the government is employing media in various ways. Let's start with what the state-controlled media are doing.
Oh, the state-controlled media are saying all the right things. They are saying that people are excited to vote. They are using all sorts of patriotic writing, songs, speeches, and so on to excite people to go to vote. They are also trying to tell to people that if you do vote, then the national security of the country will be protected, because foreign powers know that the majority of people still support this regime. And if you don't vote, you are actually siding with the enemy. The other thing that the government has been doing is publishing or broadcasting messages from conservative ayatollahs that support the government, saying that if they don't vote, when the country is facing all sorts of difficult problems, both domestically and at the international level, would be a sin.
Now, on the presumption that the government will misstate the turnout figures, various dissidents are attempting to document what they presume will be a much lower participation. How are they doing that?
A lot of people report on their blogs what they have seen. Social networks inform people of what's going on around large cities, particularly Tehran. And there are huge mailing lists by many groups that contains tens of thousands of people, urging people to send their observations of what's going on around their neighborhood in polling stations. You know, the accumulated effect of all these efforts can provide a reasonable estimate of what the turnout, the actual turnout in large cities are, as opposed to what the government may declare. One thing that I should point out is that, at least in Iran, there has always been a very important difference between presidential election and parliamentary elections, in which the issues are totally local. If people, even in these elections, still turn out on their own will and vote, most analysts and political observers in Iran do not really interpret it as the legitimacy of the regime, simply because in these elections, every issue is a local issue, and people care about their local needs with which they have been grappling. At the same time, the opposition also cares about the turnout, because they have called on people to boycott the elections.
So it isn't that the regime thinks it can fool the West into proving its legitimacy, so much as it is trying to not allow the opposition to prove to the West that it is not under heel.
Well, it is both, because the regime wants two things: to prove that the opposition does not have so much sway that it can call on people not to vote and people will heed their call for not voting. This is domestic, and at the same time, it wants to show to the outside world that the opposition forces in Iran are not as legitimate and as powerful that the outside world thinks. If they can somehow show that the majority of people did not heed their call for boycotting the elections, then that by itself is a victory of some sort for the regime.
Mohammed, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me on your program.
Mohammed Sahimi covers Iran for the website PBS Frontline Tehran Bureau. Last year, the Iranian government announced that it was developing a halal internet, an alternative to the World Wide Web, that would censor, quote, dirty and unethical content and be subject to monitoring and censorship by Iranian authorities. With the exception of China's Great Firewall, it is the most ambitious project by a government to censor the web. The details of what the halal internet will look like are unclear, but we may soon find out. The Iranian government has just announced that it will be launching this spring. Neil Ungerleiter covers international technology and cybersecurity for Fast Company. Neil, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Bob.
The halal internet. Tell me why this is safe for Muslim consumption where the regular internet is not.
It's not so much safe for Muslim consumption, it's safe for Iranian government consumption. Right now, the Iranian government's worst fear is seeing the Arab Spring or other protests, even civil society protests like the ones we're seeing in Russia, spread over to Iran. And they feel that having a nationwide closed national network, which will work like the internet but be sealed off from the outside world, would be the easiest way to stop political dissent from entering the country. In order to have websites on this halal internet, in order to post content to forums, to news sites, your personal ID number and your IP address will be registered with the Iranian government. So everything that goes on there, no matter how innocuous, will be tied to a user's individual identity.
When you build an intranet of this scale, can you build this infrastructure in such a way that it's impossible for people to escape it? Aren't users of the halal internet just one dial-up connection away from the real internet?
They are one dial-up connection away from the real internet. The fact is, individual people are smart. Governments, on the whole, they're dumb. There will always be loopholes. There will always be ways of circumventing any kind of censorship, doing satellite uplinks, using things called VPNs, virtual private networks, and various other methods. It'll just be A, very slow, and B, so difficult technically that it would take someone who's a real, well, computer nerd in order to do it.
The halal internet is apparently going to be the ultimate step, but not the only step the regime has taken to suppress the free flow of information.
In January, the Iranian government introduced legislation forcing all cyber cafes throughout the country to register the ID numbers and personal information of all users and to tie their activity to individual computers. This was coupled at the same time with massive slowdowns for Gmail, for Google, for Yahoo, for Facebook, for Twitter, leading up to the Iranian election. Right now, obviously, Iran's in a very difficult geopolitical place. The situation with Israel, Afghanistan, of course, is on their eastern border. The Arab nations, which have been having the Arab Spring events, are on the west. And Iran's very worried that events happening outside their borders will spill over into Iran. And their worst nightmare is having to deal with massive, massive internal discontent. And they figure that though it's expensive and will alienate the population, it's better to create this national intranet than to deal with the ramifications of that.
The internet is vast. How in the world does the government intend to create the content to keep the population from just freaking when they switch off the World Wide Web and switch the halal internet on?
That's the million-dollar question. We're looking at two possible models. Either the Iranian government will provide the original content, including newspapers, magazines, government ministries, and then leave it up to individual users to add content to that. Or option B, it'll just start off being just like the regular internet with individual users making their own content, but having everything unlike the regular internet being censored and monitored. And we think option B is more likely given the fact that the Iranian government has had cash flow problems.
It just seems to me that politically, the Iranian regime is making exactly the wrong move, taking away something that the public loves and perhaps distracts them from the dissatisfaction they might have living in a theocracy, because at least they have their internet. It just seems like such a self-destructive exercise.
For the Iranian government, the name of the game right now is preventing another round of unrest similar to what we saw back in 2009. It's a weird situation. It's a weird dynamic because within the Iranian government, there's always been this tension between quietly tolerating not so much anti-government, but at least ambivalent about the government's domestic cultural scene, and this very totalitarian need to control and monitor all media and all culture. The Iranian government's fear is that high gasoline prices, high food prices, and high unemployment might lead people in small towns who otherwise would support Ahmadinejad's government to come out in the streets and protest alongside Western-minded Tehranis, which puts them into this rock in a hard place.
I wonder if there will be in the halal internet an equivalent of my favorite item on the internet, failblog.org, because this whole enterprise might be Exhibit A.
It's impossible for any government to seal off their citizens from the outside world. It did not even work in North Korea, which has a much more ambitious censorship scheme than Iran could ever dream of. And I'm sure that various activist organizations and communities such as Anonymous and LulzSec will likely have a field day with this.
Neil, thank you very much.
Thanks a lot, Bob.
Neil Ungerleider covers international technology and cybersecurity for Fast Company.
Coming up, anonymity, protected, probed, and exploded all over the internet.
This is On the Media.
On the Media is supported by Reputation.com, with tools designed to help lawyers, doctors, and business professionals protect and improve their online reputations. More about controlling online reputations at Reputation.com. Support for On the Media also comes from Constant Contact, working to help small businesses turn fans into customers with social campaigns. Learn more at ConstantContact.com. The Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live healthy, productive lives, at GatesFoundation.org. And the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, for 40 years working to improve health and healthcare, on the web at RWJF.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. Heard the one about the app on your iPhone that secretly collects all your contacts and stores them on their servers? How about the photo app that vacuums up all your personal photos without your knowledge? Or how Hulu tracks where you go online even after you've asked them very nicely to cease and desist? And Facebook, they wrote the playbook that now everyone else is cribbing from. Into this shady online world of petty larceny and covert surveillance, the White House stepped last week with a new Consumer Bill of Rights. Ryan Singel writes the Threat Level blog for Wired.com, and he joins us once again. Hey, Ryan, welcome back.
Hey, Bob. Thanks for having me on.
If the Obama administration has its way, what rights will the consumer indeed have?
Well, they kind of laid out some basic principles, which is that companies that collect your data should let you know they're collecting it, and they should give you a way to see what you gave them. And the companies that collect the data should use it for limited purposes. You know, the internet industry brought this on themselves. The White House is talking about internet privacy because Silicon Valley has been so irresponsible.
But does Silicon Valley and the advertising industry slink away, chastened, or do they give each other high fives because the White House has articulated a set of principles without any legislation or actual regulation being involved?
I think there's a little bit of both. This was just sort of the beginning of a process. The FTC has a lot of leeway to go after companies for violating unfair business practices, which has never been very well defined. And if treating customers' data in a way that's not respectful or transparent gets defined as an unfair business practice, then you can have an FTC that doesn't go after every bad actor, but goes after enough that it scares the industry into cleaning up its act. We also saw the Google and Microsoft and AOL and Yahoo and a large number of other online advertisers at the same time agreed to this kind of voluntary program where if you push a little button in your browser, it says do not track, the companies will actually obey that. And so I think that was very much the industry trying to say, don't make these terrible rules. Like this time when we self-regulate, it'll actually work.
In fairness to the advertising industry, among the things that they say is that the data is really anonymized. They only care where your browser is going for the purpose of targeting you with ads, right?
That's largely true, but there's also a lot of weird stuff going on behind the scenes. So there's all these ad information exchanges, ways for them to make it so that it's not anonymous. Just be transparent. Tell me when you're collecting information. There should be a little icon, and we're starting to see this, where you can click on it. It'll tell you why they thought this was a right ad for you. Google has had this for a while. You can actually go and click on one of their ads, and it'll take you to the privacy page, and it'll explain to you what categories they think you fall into. And you can either remove those categories, you can opt out, or you can actually add more categories. Giving people that choice makes people just generally feel better, and I think it's respectful and the right thing to do.
Apart from bills of rights or FTC regulation, there are other ways to get in touch with your own data. Software that shows you what information third parties can get about you, like collusion. Are they making an impression? Are they making a dent?
Collusion won't protect you from anything. It just sort of shows you what's out there. And there's some other interesting little plugins you can use. There's one called Ghostery that will watch what sites are collecting data on you, and you can block them. There's one called Abine, A-B-I-N-E. And there's another one called Better Privacy. But I think it's bad for the internet culture for, you know, a lot of people to just always feel like they're being ripped off or spied on or treated unfairly.
It's hard for me to imagine that the Facebooks of the world will permit themselves to be slowed down by something as toothless as a bill of rights. What are they going to do?
They're mostly going to be fine. They will just have to let you delete your data or delete your account or show you a little bit more about what they've collected on you. That's not that hard for them. And the things like do not track, they don't count if you're signed into a service. It doesn't make any sense for Facebook not to track me because they have to, right? That's how the service works. Google is mimicking Facebook. Their privacy changes started on March 1st, and they've taken over the Facebook model, which is that your Google cookie is your identity. They know who you are across all the services. They combine all that info, and they're going to start giving you targeted ads based on what you've said in your Gmail, the kind of searches you've made, where you happen to be calling people if you use Google Voice. They're not going to be slowed down by this. And I don't think that's the point, is to stop that juggernaut. People like Facebook. People like Google. They're very useful services. But I also think the best thing would be maybe slow them just a little bit so they have to take the time to build transparency and fairness into their data collection practices.
Okay, Ryan. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me on, Bob.
Ryan Singel edits the Threat Level blog for Wired.com.
Anonymity online has been hotly contested since the birth of the World Wide Web. Last month, a team of researchers released a paper which demonstrated that it is possible to identify someone simply by their writing style. Arvind Narayanan is a computer science researcher at Stanford and one of the authors of the paper. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Explain how you conducted the experiment.
Certainly. We collected a huge set of blog posts comprising about 100,000 different authors. And we looked at each author's writing style, and we tried to see if we could compress that down to unique fingerprints.
Using the word since rather than because is a potential marker.
Indeed. These are roughly interchangeable, but different people might use them in different proportion. Our markers range from very simple ones, such as the frequency of various punctuation characters, to full-blown grammatical analysis of sentences. The magic comes when we put hundreds or thousands of these markers together, and that's what we did.
And you were able to correctly identify authors 20% of the time? That doesn't seem that great to me.
In the most stringent case, where we ask our algorithm to always make a guess as to who the author might be, giving it only a small amount of text, less than 1,000 words, we achieved a rate of 20%. However, when you give it more text, it goes up to 35 to 40%, or especially when you allow it to make guesses only when it's relatively confident of the answer, we're able to get an accuracy of about 80%.
You're asking an algorithm to express confidence?
That's exactly right. We developed several methods by which an algorithm could not only produce an answer, which represents who an unknown author might be, but it can also estimate its own probability of correctness.
Your algorithms did not take topic into consideration. You can identify people fairly straightforwardly by what they obsess over online, or at least it certainly would be an effective marker. Why didn't you use it?
There were two reasons. To demonstrate the validity of these algorithms, it's much clearer to compare the performance of one algorithm against another if we only look at people's writing style, because that's something inherent, whereas the topic can vary greatly from one data set to another. The second reason is that if you imagine the kind of situation where an oppressive government, let's say, might be using this algorithm, it could turn out that the victim that they're going after may have only written about something innocuous, such as recipes, on their blog under their real identity. But now they might be expressing something very sensitive, such as political speech, under cover of a pseudonym. And so if we need an algorithm to connect these two together, that algorithm will only be successful if it has been developed without incorporating any topic information, because the two topics that it needs to match are different.
Was part of your motivation for doing this research to see how much dissidents might be at risk online?
That is indeed a big part of our motivation. There are a variety of technologies that we think can be used to compromise the anonymity of dissidents around the world, and so we wanted to put this out in the public domain.
Is there any way for people to protect themselves?
Yes. A previous study by researchers at Drexel has shown that if study participants are asked to think consciously about their writing style and either try to obfuscate it or even try to mimic another person's writing style, people are reasonably good at doing this without any specialized training. If somebody wanted to produce an anonymous document but didn't want to be identified, one way to do that might be to try to mimic the writing style of some famous author.
So throw in a few forsooths and make like Shakespeare?
It's a little bit more complex than that, but basically along those lines.
Arvind, thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
Arvind Narayanan is a computer science researcher at Stanford.
For those of you who cherish anonymity, beware the transparency grenade. Berlin-based artist Julian Oliver has crafted an object that looks just like the Russian F1 hand grenade you so often see in war movies. But when you pull the pin on this grenade, it doesn't explode in fire and bits of shrapnel. It captures nearby audio and information from local wireless signals and explodes that information onto the internet. Oliver says his one-of-a-kind transparency grenade may be shaped like a standard munition, but it's packed with gadgets and layered with silver and way too precious for war.
I put so much money and care into the aesthetics of the object, working with a local metal worker, Suzanne Stauch, that I'm very reluctant to throw the thing.
It's not transparent. It's more like translucent.
That was deliberate. I mean, when you've got the little LEDs blinking away on the inside and the tiny computer doing its work, the whole thing kind of glows. That itself is very attractive. But more than that, by making it not entirely transparent, people find themselves peering into the object, if you like, or at least attempting to see what's inside. And that very gesture itself expresses a lot of the overall conceptual frame of the project, to encourage a bit of peering, you know, to find those little secrets.
What exactly makes it a grenade?
Recently, with some of the leak efforts of the likes of WikiLeaks, we've seen something as immaterial as data shaking at the walls of institutions. And I wanted to reference very much the volatility of data, the fear of it escaping, the fear of it falling into the wrong hands, et cetera, and all that anxiety is somehow best represented by an object that looks like it's going to explode.
And the way it explodes is that when you pull the pin, it takes the ambient wireless signals from a nearby router or from a cell phone, and it just distributes all of those signals outward?
Well, when you pull the pin, all of the audio that's available to the tiny microphone on the actual device and any wireless network packets within its reach, all of that data is mined by software on my server that pulls HTML fragments, emails, and places it on a map at the location of the detonation. People can visit the map, and then, as opposed to seeing fragments of buildings, one sees data distributed over the map at that sort of symbolic detonation. and the audio is available alongside.
If I wanted to render myself invulnerable to the effects of the transparency grenade, the first thing I would have to do is secure my wireless network. If I have a code to get into my router, the transparency grenade cannot decode it, correct?
There is some encryption which is extraordinarily easy to break. I mean, the best way, of course, to make yourself invulnerable to something like this grenade is to drive with your meeting partners in a car to a forest, leave your cell phones in the car and go for a walk and have your meeting in the sun somewhere. I mean, part of the project is very much to draw attention to how our increased dependence on technology makes us a little more vulnerable.
You have no malicious plans for this, I gather. You build it to show that it could be built.
It's mostly a project to draw attention to what I see to be a very worrying lack of transparency in the corporate and governmental sector. And I think many people feel more in the dark than ever before, increasingly subjects rather than partners of their governments and their agendas. And the transparency grenade is itself a kind of symbolic container for all of these different important tensions.
Yes, symbolic for now, maybe, but you have plans for a phone app for this, right? So that it wouldn't just be a magnificent museum piece representing the society's gathering vulnerabilities. It's something I can download to my phone and actually unleash on others.
I will provide an application, I'm working on it right now, that people can use to study how this kind of a system works. And also, yeah, to use it should they have a worthy need for it. I will leave it entirely up to them. They can install the app and run it at their own risk.
So what happens if the software is embraced by a criminal or a vandal? What have you unleashed here?
I would be very surprised were it not already in deployment in some form the world over. Security researchers and people that do penetration testing of corporations and offices and the like, what they're doing is they're showing points of vulnerability and simultaneously revealing to those that are dependent on that technology just how dangerous ignorance of your technological environment can be. And so I think that from that perspective, I firmly situate it as an educational project as much as a tool. I would hope that it doesn't fall into the wrong hands, but again, I'm sure that if the wrong hands are out there, they've already built it.
Julian, thank you very much.
A pleasure. Thank you.
Julian Oliver is an artist based in Berlin. Here at On the Media, we're conducting an information gathering operation of our own. Joining me now to talk about it is OTM producer Sara Abdurrahman. Sara, welcome back to this side of the mic.
Thanks, Bob. So I came across this blog post about this woman who basically on a whim sent a bunch of Freedom of Information Act requests about herself to different government agencies. And in her post, she says she sort of forgot about them until one day she got this package from the FBI with their file on her. 10 years before, when she was 18, she'd participated in some minor local protest. She doesn't ever actually explain what the protest was about. And the FBI had a detail following her for a few days, and they had this 436-page report about that 5-day span. And they followed her to the movies. They say, subject exits vehicle and enters movie theater. Subject entered Lord of the Rings. At one point, they wrote that she went into a bakery and came out carrying what they believed to be either bread or food.
All right, so this woman who found out that the government was following her made you wonder whether they have files on you too, right? Tell me why you suspect that you've been watched.
A few years ago, I was making just like a mockumentary with a friend of mine. It was not political at all. It was just a silly mockumentary based on E! True Hollywood Stories about this gender-neutral Indian pop star a la Pat from Saturday Night Live who moves to America and has this tragic rise and fall from a cough syrup addiction. It was just the most ridiculous thing ever. I was in Eastern Washington State, and we needed an airport scene, like an outside of the airport scene. So I go take like a 5-minute exterior shot of this airport, and then I'm driving back to my parents' house. A few minutes later, I get pulled over by 5 different cars, unmarked. It turns out it was Secret Service. Dick Cheney was in town doing a fundraiser. This was, I think, in 2004. They had a good laugh with the footage that they saw when I explained to them the silly plot of what we were working on. And so for sure they have a file because they took down all of my information at the time.
You suspect there's a file on you. In fact, you're sure there's something on you. and you just want to know precisely what. How do you go about applying for this?
I found one website called getmyfbifile.com, and you can select which offices you want to send to, and then it'll give you form letters to print out with the addresses and everything. If you don't want to do that, you can even go to the different departments themselves, and they all have a privacy office or some version of that that gives you instructions on how to make your own FOIA request. But I just used this website. I generated like 10 different letters. I sent to local FBI offices in the different places that I've lived. I sent to the main FBI headquarters, CIA, Secret Service, Department of Homeland Security.
Department of Agriculture, NASA.
No, Bob, not them.
When this stuff does start coming back to you, will you come back and update us?
I will, but some of it might be redacted.
Sarah, thank you.
Thanks, Bob.
Sarah Abdurrahman is a producer for On the Media. Go to onthemedia.org to see how you too can go FOIA yourself.
Coming up, more pressure on Murdoch's media empire and why movie violence is louder and squishier.
This is On the Media.
On the Media is supported by Reputation.com, with tools designed to help lawyers, doctors, and business professionals protect and improve their online reputations. More about controlling online reputations at Reputation.com. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone.
The Republicans screwed up everything. If you can't sell freedom and liberty, you suck.
Andrew Breitbart, conservative internet publisher, commentator, activist, and firebrand, died Thursday at the age of 43.
And by suck, I mean you suck profoundly.
As a youth, he worked quietly behind the scenes on the Drudge Report. Then, he said, after watching the press collude with President Clinton during the Monica Lewinsky scandal, that would certainly stun Mr. Clinton, Breitbart decided to go public.
And I said, okay, this is a center-right nation, and this mainstream media, this allegedly neutral and objective group of people, oh, indeed they are, based out of New York and Los Angeles, where I have an apartment and a house, thank you. I'm bicoastal, I'm hip, and I'm shallow. I know what you're up to. I go to your cocktail parties, and I hear your contempt for people from Middle America. Don't tell me you're neutral.
He determined, he said, to go to war against his neighbors, those bi-coastal elites and their pet causes. He put a young protege, James O'Keefe, on the payroll of his website, Big Government, where O'Keefe posted elaborately staged stings of Acorn, NPR, and Planned Parenthood. When O'Keefe was slammed for using shady techniques like deceptive editing that would never pass muster with mainstream journalism, Breitbart called it mainstream hypocrisy. Didn't NBC's Dateline send ringers dressed in Muslim garb to NASCAR rallies as a provocation? That must mean provocation is okay.
I grew up with Abby Hoffman as an idol, and Hunter Thompson and the Merry Pranksters. As long as the mainstream media tells me that it's okay when Dateline does it and when 60 Minutes does it, I'm not going to be here to criticize it when James O'Keefe did it.
For most media watchers, even Glenn Beck, Breitbart's lowest moment came when he posted a snippet of a speech to the NAACP by Shirley Sherrod, a U.S. Department of Agriculture official. It made her sound racist. But just a little later on in that speech, she described finding prejudice in herself and common cause with the white farmers it was her job to serve. The White House flinched before the facts were in and fired her.
This has ripped away the veil and shown us all that is wrong with politics today.
Political pundit David Gergen.
An ideologue injects poison into the internet. Other people rush to judgment so they can on camera. And an administration gets stampeded and commits this travesty of justice.
We are in the most exciting time ever in the history of media.
Breitbart exulted in his outrages. And his outrage. He sought it out, as when last month he stopped by a group of drumming Occupy protesters near the Conservative Political Action Conference in Washington.
Behave yourself! Behave yourself!
Okay, well, Behave yourself! Guys, chill.
You are freaks and animals! You're freaks and animals! Behave!
An odd imprecation from a man who regarded misbehavior as the better part of valor. When he died, apparently of natural causes, Twitter buzzed with the tweets of many who felt no sorrow at Breitbart's demise. Among them, Slate's Matthew Iglesias, who wrote, "Conventions around dead people are ridiculous. The world outlook is slightly improved. Andrew Breitbart, dead." Some conservative blogs took umbrage, but probably Breitbart would not have. On Thursday, Big Government quoted a new conclusion he penned for his book Righteous Indignation. He wrote, "I love finding allies, and famously, I enjoy making enemies. At the end of the day, I can look at myself in the mirror, and I sleep very well at night." James Murdoch stepped down this week as chief of News International, Rupert Murdoch's British newspapers, though he'll still be working elsewhere in his dad's media empire. James' departure follows revelations by British police investigator Sue Akers that the company had bribed multiple police officials, not just a few cops, and not just at the News of the World, but at the Sun tabloid, too. All this bad news in Britain has renewed speculation over here that the Murdochs may have run afoul of U.S. law, specifically the Watergate-era Foreign Corrupt Practices Act. The FCPA was penned to punish U.S.-based businesses who, say, bribed foreign prime ministers for fighter jet contracts. But over time, American courts have broadened the scope of the FCPA. When the News Corp phone hacking scandal first broke, most experts agreed that the scale of the scandal was too small to interest U.S. prosecutors. But ProPublica's Jake Bernstein says that assessment is old news.
Yeah, that changed this week when Sue Akers, who was the Deputy Assistant Commissioner of the Metropolitan Police in London, testified before a parliamentary commission.
Payments have been made not only to police officers, but to a wide range of public officials. There also appears to have been a culture at the Sun of illegal payments, and systems have been created to facilitate those payments whilst hiding the identity of the officials receiving the money.
What's particularly problematic for News Corp is there's a part of the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act called the Books and Records provision. It's sort of this weird catch-22 where if you don't properly account for the bribes that you have been giving to foreign officials, that can put you in quite a bit of trouble. And so it seems like Akers at least was sort of hinting at the fact that there was a pattern where people at the papers knew that this was wrong and that they weren't properly accounting for these payments to government officials. So that could be quite problematic.
But the thing is that either the evidence of corruption is broad enough to fall under this act in the United States or it isn't. When will we know?
These kinds of investigations can take years. Part of what justice wants to know, and apparently News Corp is investigating this themselves, is how widespread is this? Is this just two newspapers in Britain, or was this happening at other media outlets across the company and across the world? It's clear that News Corp has been handing over material to the police, and presumably they would hand over material to the FBI and to the Justice Department as well. What Murdoch wants to do is draw a line under this and say, this was the past, these behaviors were terrible, and we don't do that anymore, we've got new procedures in place so that this won't happen again. And the way you can do that and convince a government to go easy on you is by making a clean breast of the whole affair. So I think if there was other stuff going on, then both governments are going to know about it fairly soon.
In earlier testimonies, we have seen evidence that Rupert Murdoch has been actively involved in all of his companies with daily morning phone calls. I just don't know how he can stay with the company and yet now declare the company to be clean when it would seem he would have known of these practices all along. And the fact that James Murdoch has stepped down from the company's British properties doesn't really mean anything.
Well, there's been some turnover at the newspapers themselves. I mean, he closed News of the World, of course. And I think, I mean, that's going to be a balancing act for Murdoch is sort of how do you make the case that this behavior is a thing of the past, but keep all the same people in place. Some people are going to probably have to be sacrificed. There's only so many executives you can ship to publications in Australia. There are definitely shareholders of News Corp who are actively asking for changes at the top. And if there was a settlement with Justice over the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act, then those calls will probably even get louder.
Up for any prognostication, Jake?
If I had to guess, I would guess that there will be a settlement, that it'll happen sometime in the next year or two, that this won't go to trial, and that it will ultimately, given the size of the company, not be that big a deal.
So we'll all wake up and find out this was just a dream.
Yes.
Jake, thank you very much.
Thank you, Brooke.
Jake Bernstein is a business and financial reporter for ProPublica. Once movies were silent, and maybe again if Oscar-winning The Artist has legs, but nowadays mostly cringe-inducing bone crunches and deathly squishes are requisite elements of the action movie experience. And most of the time we accept those squishes and splats as reality-based. When was the last time you actually saw someone sawing their arm off? How do sound editors know what it really sounds like? Slate senior editor Daniel Engber says it's all in their gruesome imaginations. Dan, welcome to On the Media.
Thank you.
So a lot of the sound editors that you spoke to said that they aren't even going for realism.
You know, it's almost like they reject the idea that there is a real sound, because who would know what it sounds like to hear a head being stomped in an elevator? And so they talk about sounds that access some emotional response directly. You don't think, does that sound realistic? You just react with fear or disgust.
And you mention in your piece that the face stomping scene in Drive is a potent and precise soundtrack for brutality. Could you describe it as we play it?
So it starts with the hum and creak of the elevator as they're heading down to the garage. And at this point, the character played by Ryan Gosling sees that the other passenger in the elevator is carrying a gun, and he concludes that this is a hitman. As he realizes that he and Carey Mulligan's characters are in danger, the elevator noises start to sort of suck out of the scene. It gets very kind of surreal, and there's this slow motion segment, and the lights fade, and the music comes up. The Ryan Gosling character kisses the Carey Mulligan character, and you don't know if this is really happening or in his head. Aside from the music, there's no sound effects whatsoever. And then as they finish the kiss, the elevator sounds come back, and he erupts in violence, and he grabs this hitman, smashes him against one wall of the elevator and then another, knocks the guy on the floor, and then begins to stomp on him. And then you'll hear the stomps, and he stomps on his head 17 times in this sequence. And you can also hear Ryan Gosling's character breathing.
You know, it's almost worse to hear than it was to see.
Yes.
And I guess that's the point. You say that a lot of times these violent scenes are orchestrated like musical chords.
The sound editors describe it as orchestrating a musical chord. One talked to me about how you would create all the different frequency bands of this sound. So you'd start with the most basic part of a Hollywood punch is swinging a piece of wood against a side of beef. That's how the sort of thudding bass note is generated. Then you need to add some sort of high frequency stuff, a little bit of crackle. So maybe you're snapping some dry twigs or crumpling up some plastic cups. And then you want to add something to fill out the middle of the sound. A little goopy, like dropping a fruit on cement. And by mixing those three components, you can get a really full, layered sound.
Well, let's talk about sound inflation. You talked about punching before. That's mm-hmm. a great place to begin. Mm-hmm. There is something that was called, way back in the 30s, the Paramount Punch. And you said it's still used today in some places. It's the sound of leather on leather, right? Like two baseball mitts being mm-hmm. slapped together.
It's a simple sound. And then as over time, sound editors have added bits to it and layered on top of it, such that now when we hear a punch in a movie, we expect to hear something bigger, louder, more resonant.
I wanted to take you on a little trip mm-hmm. to 1976, Rocky. And we're going to put that right up against 2010's The Fighter. They both happen in the ring.
That's Rocky. In those two movies, which I do think are comparable, there's such a difference between the 70s and the 2000s. You can really hear the wetness in the more recent film.
You've also noted that maybe in reaction, there are some films that actually make use of silence.
One of my favorite examples is Raging Bull, which has some of the most extravagant and stylized sound effects of punching and violence. And yet there are also moments where it just gets to almost total silence right before the violence, and it's that contrast has a tremendous effect. Jake LaMotta is about to get knocked out by Sugar Ray Robinson, and there's just a shot of Sugar Ray standing there, and it gets very quiet. There's sort of a rumbling, hissing sound. And then he just unleashes this barrage of punches. And there's animal sounds and jet engines and flashbulbs as that just run of punches goes through.
Have we just gotten so accustomed to the exaggerated sounds of cinema violence that it has become natural to our acclimatized ears?
I hadn't really thought about these issues before. I had one of the sound editors say to me that when people hear things while watching a movie, they'll swear that they saw something on screen that they didn't actually see. And I found that it goes both ways. Sometimes the sound takes over in my memory and I forgot that I saw things. So in that scene in Drive that we started with, I forgot that there's actually a very disgusting image that I think was actually unnecessary. But the sound just took over and I just imagined what I'd seen.
Do natural sounds begin to sound fake?
Oh, yeah. I think, you know, if you just recorded someone punching someone else in the face, it would sound ridiculous in a movie at this point. And probably at any point. You know, I'm saying at this point as if we've fallen from grace. No, I think in 1933 it would have sounded ridiculous. Even the Paramount punch was just a couple of baseball gloves being slapped together or whatever it was.
You talked to an ex-Foley artist who said that a good example of a real sound sounding fake was in Fight Club, where the fisticuffs begin in a natural register, and that's what sounds fake. And then it starts to sound more real once it gets escalated?
Yeah, that example's from Lisa Coulthard, who's a professor of film studies in Vancouver, and the first time Edward Norton's character punches Brad Pitt. It's kind of a more, what she describes as a more realistic, muffled sound. And in the movie, he's a little tentative. I think that's why they went with the softer sound. But then as they get more into the idea of the Fight Club, it sort of comes back to what we expect today as a real Hollywood punch.
When I'm watching a movie, I tend to buy that, you know, the sound is right. I've never ripped an Achilles tendon, but I'll accept maybe that's how it sounds. I seem to be more demanding about the way the violence looks. Is that weird?
Not weird to me. I mean, only since talking to the sound editors and writing this article have I started to think about this. I just watched a TV show last night, and there was a sound of someone's neck being broken. And I thought, for the first time I can remember, wow, that sounds ridiculous. But I must have heard lousy, violent sound effects in the past. But I think I've always attributed whatever shortcoming there was in the sound to what I was seeing on the screen.
So what you're saying is that for the last couple of decades, realism has been irrelevant. Maybe it's always been irrelevant. We're just building fake upon fake.
I think realism has been irrelevant from the start. We can imagine that we are in the midst of violent sound inflation and that 20 years from now, when someone punches someone else, there's going to be the sound of a nuclear bomb going off. But I think it's more that, you know, there's no starting point that's real and the convention just drifts. And we're drifting towards squishy now and we may drift towards crunchy and maybe we'll drift back towards dry in 20 years.
Sounds like you're describing breakfast cereal.
Again, I'm hungry.
Daniel, thank you very much.
Thanks, Brooke.
Daniel Engver is a senior editor at Slate.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Jamie York, Alex Goldman, PJ Vogt, Sara Abdurrahman, and Chris Neary, with more help from Lina Anwar and Hannah Sheehan. We're both leaving us this week. It has been so nice to have you. Thank you for all your hard work. The show was edited by Brooke. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineer this week was Andrew Dunn.
Katya Rogers is our senior producer. Ellen Horn is WNYC's senior director of national programs. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. Go to our website to see our latest offerings in our Media Scrutiny Theater series. Seriously, check it out at onthemedia.org. On the Media is produced by WNYC and distributed by NPR. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for On the Media comes from the Ford Foundation, the Jane Marcher Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing. Or
politics.
Country music.
Hockey.
Sex. Of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.